Good afternoon. I'm Callie Crossley, and this is the Callie Crossley Show. When it comes to food in America, there is no end of contradictions. We have an obesity crisis alongside a hunger epidemic in the land of supersized plenty. Well, my guest, Doug Rao, sees all of this is connected, and he's working to do something about it. He's the former president of Trader Joe's, and currently he's an advanced leadership fellow at Harvard studying food waste and healthier eating. He also sits on the board of overseers at WGBH. Doug Rao, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Why study food waste?
Well, in my 31 years with Trader Joe's and before that 4 years in the food industry, it always astonished me how much absolutely perfectly good food is thrown out at the end of each day at the retail level. And in, I get mailings just like everyone else, and I listen to the news and hear that hunger is growing in America. We obviously have some serious issues with the distribution. And it just seemed as the richest food nation in the history of the world to have people that have food insecurity or hunger didn't make much sense. So I wanted to study it.
Now, let's just be clear. When we say food waste, you know, my mind goes to rotting vegetables. That's not what we're talking about, though.
No. I mean, that, to some degree, we can say that. But the USDA in 1997 commissioned a large study, and it was astonishing to find that at the end of that, 40% of all the food grown in America is never consumed. Most of that occurs waste in the fields or in processing, but a percentage of it occurs at retail. And that was the area I wanted to focus on because that's what I knew. And we're talking about food that at, 10 minutes earlier would sell for full retail, but 10 minutes after closing goes into the dumpster and on the way to a landfill. The astonishing thing, too, as you start to research this, is that a quarter of all the fresh water in America that's used for groundwater goes towards producing this food waste, and along with 300 million barrels of oil.
Wow. That's so we're really talking big dollars here.
Yeah. And what we're also talking about is retail level is only 2 to 3% of the food waste. It's astonishingly small. Yet that alone is 5.4 billion pounds a year. So that's billion with a B. It's a lot of food.
Now, okay, anybody listening is going to think, all right, look, I know, I've heard my grocer or whatever, I know they're giving away food that's been slightly damaged. I also know that even before they give away, that you can go to the shelf where they'll tell you it's a day old or whatever, and I can buy it more cheaply. So how is this still happening beyond that?
Well, it's a really good question. And I think the answer is that, first of all, there are many states, including Massachusetts, where it's regulated that you cannot distribute out-of-code product. So if you—
And what does that mean, out-of-code?
Well, it means, for instance, you have a loaf of bread that says sell by August 12th. At the end of business today, they cannot legally distribute that to a food bank or anyone else. And so, therefore, that's not true in all states, but it's true that when you have product that's being regulated, that's for food safety issues primarily, of course.
Liability, I guess.
Yeah, liability, yeah. And just food safety issues. I think it's a complex problem. It's like many things. The more you dig into it, the more you find that it has interconnected and interrelated parties. And the same way for me, when I started to look at food waste, it started as a supply side issue. I mean, I knew the retail industry had all this food. And then I also am getting mailings from Feeding America and Greater Boston Food Bank that, hunger and shortages are real things. You think, well, it's just connecting the dots, mm-hmm. a logistic issue, if you would. The more you look at it, the more you realize that, well, it's also a demand side issue, that the real issue in America is that it's not just that hunger in America is not enough calories, but as the stereo, the cliche goes, that it's eating the wrong calories. And for economic reasons that decisions are being made, as we know, to consume soda, for instance, instead of milk for kids because it's cheaper.
Let me pick up on something because you're also saying that we as consumers contributed to food waste. I mean, let's not lay it all on the retailers that we do too. And I'm just going to tell my own little story. I like a small cup of coffee at Dunkin' Donuts. Thank you very much. They will not sell me that, or they will, but I'll have to pay twice as much. So if I buy a median cup, then I'm, paying a reasonable price for it. So what happens? I throw it away. This is ridiculous.
Yeah, I think that there have been a lot of stories. Now, I've read, for instance, that the small soda at a fast food chain today is the same size as a large back in the 60s. And I think we've seen this in the documentary on Supersize, did a lot about this. I mean, The other night I was at a movie with a friend, and of course you buy popcorn, and you feel like an idiot if you buy the small one, because for $1 or $2 more, you get one that's two or three times the size. And of course, they always tell you this. Not that you would need to eat it, or should eat it, or even would eat it.
Exactly. And I end up getting the small, by the way. I do resist that. Now, you are a part of this program that's brand new at Harvard, so let's talk about that for a moment, which is affording you an opportunity to sort of look at this whole problem globally. It's called the Advanced Leadership Fellowship. And what it really does is take folks like yourself with a high level of expertise in many areas and are pulling across the disciplines of Harvard University, the business school, the Kennedy School, all of them, to allow you to think about ways in which to solve significant social problems, especially those affecting health and welfare and children and the environment, with a focus on community and public service. So what is the benefit of having someone like yourself with the kind of expertise that you have had at Trader Joe's now able to presumably, because you have to work for real, and you worked in the real world, so you know what it takes to get something done, move to the next step and implement that which you have come up with while you've been studying?
Well, it's a great question. And first of all, this program I'm delighted with. It's a wonderful opportunity, first of all, to work with the faculty. I want kudos to Rosabeth Moss Cantor and to David Gergen and Barry Bloom and Peter Zimmerman and the people that put this together. This year there are 22 cohorts in this program, and they're just a wonderful group of people, very skilled from both public policy and from the corporate world. And the idea behind it really is taking people that have had success and experience in what they've done in one career and are ready to transition. They want to make a change in some way to tackle some large social ills, as you mentioned, health, poverty, education, et cetera. And what I liked about it, what attracted me to the program, was that it was self-directed and free-ranging, so that you got to look at what project attracted you from your own background and experience. And that the most important thing to me was it wasn't to come up with another white paper,
or it's to really do something.
To do a theory.
Yeah.
But the idea is, and the whole emphasis is, you're ready to actually do something, either in joining and, after mapping the terrain, figuring out here's the best organization out there and I think I've got something to offer. Let me see what I can do. Or forming another organization that can either help network and coordinate the existing ones or actually starts its own venture.
Well, you have an idea about how you think you could move some of this food waste. Why don't you share it?
Well, I have lots of ideas. I like to preface this by saying that I'm still in the midst of this project.
Right.
So I don't want this to come across as conclusions. And certainly I wouldn't want any FedEx or UPS driver out there right now to think this was ill-hatched. But the problem's quite clear if you look at the supply side, which is that every supermarket, restaurant, et cetera, in America, at the end of the day has product that they weren't able to use. And right now, only about 25% of the retailers are actually part of the Feeding America Food Bank program. So they've got a large number of retailers that just are not able to or don't have the resources to get this to a food bank or a soup kitchen, et cetera. So the idea was, well, you either can go out and try and attract donations to hire trucks and drivers all across America, quite expensive, with our dedicated trucks to go out and do this, or you look at people that are already out on the road. Who is it that already knows how to pick up and deliver cheaper than anybody in the world? And you have to go to, obviously FedEx and UPS and UPS the United Parcels, Post Office. So if you can get the people that are already out there, already have the truck and driver, in some way to be incentivized, have it make sense to them, then I think that you got most of the problem licked. And the point I want to make about this isn't like Alzheimer's, where we actually don't know, how to cure it. We don't know what really causes it. We don't really have the answers. We're searching, obviously, and much money and dedication is going towards solving that. This is something we actually do. Here's the food, and here's where people
are.
Here are the people. Mm-hmm. It's really about, do we have the will as a nation? Do we have the will as a country to take care of this? And because this isn't rocket science. It's really just blocking and tackling, as they say. It's, connecting the dots.
Let me just make people aware once again of why it's important to connect some of these dots on the hunger side. There are, according to Project Bread's 2009 status report on hunger, 554,000 people in Massachusetts struggling to put food on the table. Now, 8.3%, that's what it totals to. And half of those people are really hungry. 8.3% means they're food insecure. That's the term they like to use. Maybe they get some, maybe they don't. And a large part of these are children. There are several initiatives trying to work toward feeding kids, but also trying to feed them nutritionally, which is the other half of what you're trying to do in, in your program. Project Bread has a Chefs in School initiative. We interviewed one of those top chefs who's working very hard to try to improve that. These are all small initiatives, but they can add up in a big way. So if you have somebody like yourself who's a big guy, who's run a big corporation, I know I'm serious, who can look out there and pull these pieces together, this is a good thing.
Well, thank you. And certainly, you know, I think that you're right. I think that, you know, this is one of those things where it's going to take a lot of both small, local initiatives and actions and some state, you know, local and even federal coordination and support, I think, to really crack this. This is becoming the Wall Street Journal had in May a front page section of in their weekend journal that really dealt with this whole issue. And basically, they estimated that this is a $35 to $40 billion problem and growing rapidly. And so this is a serious problem for all of us. For anyone who thinks that this may or may not apply to them, the reality is that when you've got the numbers that you're talking about here, it impacts all of us. And I think that there's some wonderful things going on. Absolutely some wonderful things up and down the country and the various touch points in food. I think that, you know, one of the things that, for instance, you know, we have to look at is that it's when you get into the problem on the demand side, which is creating interest or how to use nutritional food, there's a lot of factors that play in, everything from, as we know, advertising tie-ins with fast food chains to stimulate, you know, purchases because of the action figure, you know, et cetera, to the fact that there's just a lack of nutritional education. And when you even get into the SNAP program, the what used to be called food stamps,
right,
that, you know, one of the things that I'm looking at and just, you know, mapping is what would it take to start to incentivize and give credits or rewards for, food behavior that actually maps the food pyramid, or in other words, better eating. And those to the degree that someone eats more nutritionally, they actually get more credit, because we know that in the long run, it's going to cost us a lot less in health care, lost job, et cetera.
Well, I mean, if I'm expecting anybody to be able to do it, I expect you to be able to do it, because as the president of Trader Joe's, you brought Trader Joe's to the East Coast. You branded that company. I mean, one could say, why do we need another grocery store? You know, but you made it its own thing, and with a particular kind of a characteristic that people were attracted to. So you are in a position now to figure out how to brand this. Are we at a point, I think we are, where people are becoming more aware? We've got so many documentaries looking at the issues around food.
Yep.
Food Inc. I almost made it to, you know, get an Oscar this year.
Wonderful, wonderful documentary.
Exactly. So we're thinking about it. Even if we don't act it out personally in our own lives, we know something about this, right?
Yeah. Well, I think it really is an idea whose time has come. I think that obviously, you know, Jamie Oliver and Michelle's Let's Move, there's a lot of momentum and attention, and I think the timing is right. And more than that, I hope that the will here and the recognition that this is everyone's problem, this isn't someone else's problem, that this is something that we as a country need to address before it becomes a much larger problem. And I think that the time is right. Now, you know, I don't have aspirations to, you know, solve all the problems. This is a very complex, it's a very large issue, but to the degree that one can even be a small catalyst towards it, then it makes getting out of bed in the morning worthwhile.
In about a year, you know, you're going to finish up this program before a year, but let's say, you know, 5 years, I'll give you 5 years from now. what would you like to see happening based on what you've learned and what you'd like to begin to resolve with around these issues?
Well, I think that, I mean, one should have, as they say, big, hairy, audacious goals. And I think that one should dream large. And, you know, I often like the fact that, you know, Martin Luther King didn't have a 5-year plan. He had a dream. So the idea is that the dream here is that we've got the ability to feed all of our citizens nutritional food that they can afford and that we have the food. It's right now literally going to dumpsters and becoming a problem in our landfill. You look at, I mean, just from an environmental issue, what it took to produce that food, and then now with methane and all this other stuff. I mean, it becomes something where it just makes no sense. Hopefully, by raising awareness, by bringing about some of the parties that are interested in this, I think that we can, several years from now, look back and say real progress has been made on becoming a healthier America and having less food actually make it to the dumpster.
What are your own eating habits?
Well, I try to eat well. Mm-hmm. I do enjoy my heart medicine every now and then. It's called dark chocolate.
Okay.
I think the key is to have a balanced life. You can try to exercise, try to eat, you know, within moderation, and you know you try to be aware of what of good nutrition.
All right. Well, we're expecting a lot of you because you're about to be a big Harvard grad.
Oh, dear.
We've been speaking with Doug Rao. He's the former president of Trader Joe's, and currently he's an advanced leadership fellow at Harvard studying food waste and healthier eating. He also sits on the board of overseers at WGBH. Doug Rao, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks, Kelly.
Up next, it's a look at the governor's race. No, not here in little old Rhode Island. Stay with us.
Support for WGBH comes from you and from the Office of Cultural Affairs and Special Events. Lowell area restaurants open their doors for Restaurant Week, August 1st through the 15th. Lowell, a city of world culture. More info at cultureiscool.org. And from the New England Mobile Book Fair in Newton, New England's independent bookstore. The Book Fair is your summer reading list headquarters. More details online at nebookfair.com. That's nebookfair.com. And from Skinner, auctioneers and appraisers of antiques and fine art. You might consider auction when downsizing a home or disposing of an estate. 60 auctions annually, 20 collecting categories. Boston and Marlboro. Online at SkinnerInc.com.
In 1994, filmmaker Ken Burns told the story of America's pastime. Simply titled Baseball, this epic film fit 150 years into 9 full innings. Now, Ken Burns has returned to the ballpark with his 4-hour documentary, The 10th Inning, to include the historic 2004 World Series victory by the Boston Red Sox. Set aside your copy of this updated collection at a price below retail at WGBH.org.
Police were stumped by the murder of a restaurant manager until Richard Walter saw the crime scene and concluded it wasn't a robbery.
I found then that the primary focus was an intense anger against the victim.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Richard Walter about investigating cold cases and with Michael Capuzzo, author of The Murder Room. Join us.
If you've recently received an envelope from WGBH asking you to renew your membership, please return it as soon as you can. August 31st marks the end of the fiscal year for WGBH, and your support in any amount will make a big difference. Thanks.
I'm Callie Crossley, and this is the Callie Crossley Show. Today we're turning our attention to the governor's race in Rhode Island, where the Republican-turned-independent Lincoln Chafee and Democratic State Treasurer Frank Caprio are in a statistical tie. Joining me to talk about the race and what it says about Rhode Island to have these two men leading the pack is Robert Whitcomb. Robert Whitcomb is the vice president and editorial page editor of the Providence Journal. Robert Whitcomb, welcome back.
Hi, Callie. Nice to hear from you.
Well, you got to tell us why this race has settled into these two men.
Big names. Lincoln Chafee was a former U.S. senator. His father was a rather famous national figure. Senator John H. Chafee was also Navy Secretary. before he was appointed to the senatorship, if you will, by the former governor Ammon. Chafee was the mayor of the second biggest city in Rhode Island. Not that that means much nationally, but Warwick, Rhode Island. So he's very well known, both in terms of his own political career and his family's, and he's a member of an old, what you'd call, 19th century mercantile aristocratic family. He's our equivalent of the Boston Brahmins.
Okay.
And the other guy is a guy called Frank Caprio, who's the treasurer of the state, and he comes from a very well-known political family, too, kind of a well-off, obviously, Italian-American family, and he's got sort of a spiffy background. He went to Harvard and wears a Harvard tie, and nobody's perfect. And he is sort of socially maybe a little more conservative than Link Chafee. Link Chafee is a species of the Rockefeller Republican that we used to know a lot more of, see a lot more of. So these are two big statewide names. He's the Caprio family. I mean, another thing about Caprio, his father is a judge and the chairman of the Board of Higher Education in Rhode Island. And his father is also a television personality. He has a show called Caught in Providence, where people in this courtroom are dragged in for parking violations and stuff, and he good-humoredly lectures them. So he's Frank Capria's father is sort of a show business celebrity of a sort around here. But I should intercede. Maybe Rhode Island's too small to even have a governor. That's another issue.
Oh, I don't think.
Why is it a state? I don't know.
Okay, I'm going to send the emails to Robert Whitman.
Yes, that's right. Well, they'll get lost to the 1,000 other ones they get every day. Yeah.
What are the philosophical, the ideological differences between these two?
Yeah, I'd say they aren't really that different. Chafee is not a Tea Party Republican by any means. I mean, he's running as independent. His background is as a liberal Republican. Caprio is, well, socially, in terms of socialism, probably a little more conservative, is a fairly standard kind of lunch pail Democrat around here, you know, kind of a Truman Democrat. And I don't think under either, with either one of them, you'd have a major decreasing the size of state government. And I don't think there'd be a major change in tax policy, anything like that. I do think they'd probably go after pensions, because here, as in most other states in the union, you know, the public employee pensions have become a real problem. And whoever gets elected is going to have to deal with that big time. But I think there's really not that much difference between Chafee and Caprio, I think, in the way in their policies. Their styles are very different. Chafee is sort of quirky and, I wouldn't say whimsical, but sometimes a little ethereal, while Frank Caprio is more, you know, sort of old-fashioned, he's sort of square-jawed politician.
Well, you know, usually people aren't paying attention until after Labor Day. That's the standard rap.
That's
but
very true.
Brown University just did a poll and shows that there's a dead heat between the two. So somebody's paying attention.
Yeah, and I think actually a lot of people, because they're both well known. There are some other races by there, the independent, and there are a couple of Republicans that are duking it out. But I don't think, you know, unless we're hit by an asteroid or something, I don't think the Republicans, a guy called Victor Moffat or John Robitaille, are really going to be big players. This really is between Chafee and Caprio, I think largely because they're well-known names. Chafee because of his past jobs and his sort of aristocratic family, and Caprio because he is treasurer and, you know, in a time of fiscal crisis. And is sort of good looking and, you know, kind of spiffy. So they're both how do I put it? To most, they're both well known to most Rhode Islanders. I'd say both and quite, I think in their own ways, quite acceptable to most Rhode Islanders.
They are both. Of course, Lincoln Chafee has much more money, but
oh yeah, he's got files, including indirectly from the company I work for.
His
wife is a big heiress to stock in the old Providence Journal Company. And when this place was merged into the AH Bilo company, she made a lot of money off that.
Oh, well,
yeah, I was not one of those people.
Oh, too bad. One of my my point by bringing that up is that, you know, they would be considered elite in a lot of circles. And,
yeah,
and that
yeah.
would be a bad word, but it doesn't seem to
I'll tell you, Kaylee, that's a very good point. I should emphasize Caprio is not super rich. I mean, he's well off. His families are well off. And, well, Lincoln Chafee is very rich. But there's a sort of funny tradition in Rhode Island. It goes way back of occasionally electing aristocrats to these jobs. So sometimes the governorship, the Senate, Claiborne Pell, whom I know you well remember, the current as U.S. Senator, Foreign Relations Committee Chairman, Sheldon Whitehouse, the current person, U.S. Senator. I mean, they're all sort of blue bloods, and there is a sort of a strong tradition in Rhode Island of electing, it's almost sort of feudal in a way, of electing aristocrats to certain jobs.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting since Rhode Island is leading in unemployment.
Yeah, I think we're actually behind Nevada.
Okay, all right, finally.
Yeah, the gambling business. Yeah, we're right up there, though. You're right. We're usually in the top three or four.
Let me remind my listeners that I am speaking with Robert Whitcomb, who is the vice president and editorial page editor of the Providence Journal. And we're talking about the governor's race in Rhode Island, where Republican turned independent Lincoln Chafee is facing off Democratic State Treasurer Frank Caprio. Now, here's something that's interesting. They don't appear to be going for the we're both just like you kind of approach, which is what everybody is doing across the country. Everybody who's running now, I'm just like you. In fact, Tim Cahill in Massachusetts uses those very words.
I know he does. I know he does. Yeah, the proverbial guy you wanted to have a beer with, sort of like George W. Bush. Remember that?
Yeah.
Who would you rather have a beer with, Bush or Kerry? Well, I don't know.
Why isn't that their approach in Rhode Island?
Well, I don't think Rhode Islanders are that. I don't think they're that swayed by sort of the common man routine. I think, and also, I mean, Caprio, to be fair, Caprio is more in that direction than Senator Chafee. But there's a tradition here of, you see it in a few other states, sometimes in Massachusetts, certainly in New York, of saying, well, we're going to elect people who are, I don't know, better than us. Is that the right word? But sort of above it all. There's a little bit of that. Mm. And also, no one would believe it with Link Chafee. Everyone knows about his background. It's well known. He's got tons of money and about his family. And a lot of people find that kind of alluring in the same way they like the Roosevelts and Rockefellers, Rockefeller in New York.
But let me remind you that George Bush did make that work very well for him.
That's right. He did work. Yeah, he presented himself as one of the guys. I mean, it was fraudulent. I think he wasn't one of the guys. He was extremely rich preppy, but it worked. And here, I don't think that approach is surprisingly ineffective in Rhode Island.
Okay, well, here's something else. Former President Clinton came in and stumped for Caprio, and Lincoln Chafee in the 2008 election backed Obama. So we have to assume that, you know, he'll get some Obama support, or at least, you know, even on a low level, he'll get some.
Yeah.
So we are set up here for another kind of Clinton Obama endorsement battle. We just saw earlier this week that when that happened, Obama beat out Clinton in Colorado because his candidate.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's maybe a surprise to many people. I don't think, Kaylee, it's going to have much impact one way or the other. I will say the Clintons are actually the smallness of the state are actually, they like Rhode Island a lot. They're here a lot, but partly because one of their big fundraisers in the past, Jack McConnell, lives here. But I don't think the Obama-Clinton thing is really have much effect one way or the other.
All right.
Chafee will get some of the old Yankee Republicans to vote for him, and he'll get some of the liberals because of his stand against the Iraq War and his opposition to George W. Bush in general. Well, Caprio would tend to get the kind of traditional Democrats.
What does it mean if Caprio wins, and what does it mean if Chafee wins?
I think if Chafee wins, I think there'll be a restructuring, kind of a reconfiguration of the parties around here. That's a very good question. I think if he wins, remember, and well, listeners should remember this, he's running as independent. I think it could act as a whole sort of a kind of a kind of fragment and then kind of recoalescent new parties around here. I think it'll change the Republican Party, maybe make the Republican Party here even more kind of coherently conservative, and it will probably change the Democrats a bit too. So if Chafee does win, I think it's going to have a big impact on kind of who's in which party. If Caprio wins, I don't think it's going to have much impact. You know, the long-term structure of the parties around here. But certainly if Chafee wins as an independent, which is what he's running for, it's gonna cause a real shift, you know, real sort of geological shifts in the party structure.
One of the trends that was noted this past week, everybody's looking for a trend, is that Democrats tended to stick with established candidates where Republicans just wanted the newbies and some new faces.
That's kind of the throw the rascals out.
Exactly.
The very, very, yeah, very astute point, Kelly. I think the Republicans are the angry party with the kind of the negative motion behind them, and they want to throw everybody out, you know, and they, even if it means, say, electing a wrestling mogul in Connecticut to the U.S. Senate.
Yeah.
But they're very activated by that. But as I know in the letters to the editor business, people are generally far more energized by opposition than by support. And that's sort of the problem of Democrats this year, you know, and kind of hovering over it, President Obama. And I think you see that everywhere. Here, I think it's a little bit more a matter of personalities, you know, whether you like Chafee as a person and his sort of history, his family history, or Caprio more.
Mm.
I think it actually doesn't have that much to do with parties. There is sort of a Tea Party-ish wing of what's left of the Republican Party here that's angry and, you know, wants to cut all the taxes and all that stuff. But I don't think it's very important here. Nothing like it would be in, you know, out west, for example.
Is it going to stay as tight as it is now or as the Brown's poll seems to suggest?
I think so, Kelly. Yeah, I would think so because they're both well-known characters. And given some scandal, and I don't, you know, some personal scandal, I can't think of one at this point. Something would come out. We aren't talking about Bill Clinton here with all sorts of surprises and interns. I mean, these are in their personal lives. These people are rather stodgy. So I think it's very close. Who would win? I don't know. Somebody put a gun to my head. I'd have to give the edge to Caprio simply because it is a Democratic state. And he's sort of a, you know, attractive candidate and well-spoken. But Chafee certainly could win. There's a lot of goodwill toward him.
So there's going to be a lot of handshaking around Labor Day weekend.
Schmoozing, clam bakes, yeah, and thrilly personality. You aren't going to see a lot of ideologies you'd see in a race for, you know, governor of Tennessee or something like that.
All right. I've been talking with Robert Whitcomb. He's the vice president and editorial page editor of the Providence Journal. Robert Whitcomb, come back again soon. Always great to have you on.
Oh, I'd love to. Love your show, Kelly. Thanks for inviting me.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Up next, we continue the Shakespeare conversation with our arts and culture contributor, Eugen Koh. Don't touch that dial. We'll be back after this break. Stay with us.
Support for WGBH comes from you and from M. Steinert & Sons in Boston and Natick, open for the Massachusetts sales tax holiday August 14th and 15th, offering pianos from Steinway, Essex, Boston, and Roland on the web at msteinert.com. And from Newbury Court, overlooking the Sudbury River in Concord, Mass., a full-service residential community for persons over the age of 62. You can learn more at newburycourt.org, a Deaconess Abundant Life community. And from The Lenox, the original boutique hotel, celebrating its 110th anniversary with major renovations to its restaurants and rooms. For reservations, including their special anniversary package, you can visit them at lenoxhotel.com.
Weekends are great for getting together with friends.
From WBEZ Chicago, it's This American Life.
First, say hello to a television personality and a contributor to CBS Sunday Morning, Mr. Mo Rocca is right here.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross.
Welcome back to Bob Edwards Weekend.
My guest is one-woman band, Teresa Anderson.
Spend time with your public radio friends all weekend long here on the new 89.7 WGBH Radio.
August 31st, the end of the fiscal year for WGBH. It's a lot like the end of the month for many listeners. It's when 89.7 sits down with the bills to make sure that there's enough money to cover the cost of bringing you quality independent programs. Dues to NPR, production studios, special events, they're all very expensive. But if you agree that public radio is worth every penny, then please get involved with a contribution before August 31st. Just click the donate link at WGBH.org.
This is 89.7
WGBH, Boston's NPR station.
For trusted voices and local conversation.
With fresh air.
And the Cali Crossley Show.
The new 89.7 WGBH.
I'm Cali Crossley, and this is the Cali Crossley Show. My guest, Eugene Coe, our arts and culture contributor, has been taking in the local Shakespeare productions that have graced our stages this summer. He is a professor of English at Wellesley College. Eugene Coe, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure, always.
Well, I want to let our listeners know that this is a conversation that is framed with a lot of gravitas because Shakespeare is your meat and potatoes. So this is what you write and talk about it quite a bit and are an expert in it. So we're anxious to find out what you thought about these local Shakespeare productions.
Okay. And I'm anxious to tell you.
Okay.
Which one would you like me to start with?
Well, we talked yesterday with Seth Gilliam, who starred in Othello, or who is starring in Othello in Shakespeare in the Park here on the Boston Common. And I thought it was fabulous, but I was
just a visitor,
right. Not an expert.
I enjoyed Seth Gilliam's segment yesterday. I thought he was very articulate, and he gave a great account of what makes Othello interesting for him. I thought his performance was also terrific. It was powerful. It was moving. And I thought richly layered. It was not a one-note Othello by any means. And I should also say that I was very impressed by his delivery, by which I mean that he did a terrific job of combining naturalistic speech rhythms with the musicality and the gorgeous flourishes of the verse to make the language, the extraordinary language of Othello, seem organic and real.
And of these times. I mean, we're talking 17th century work
that
seems to fit right in today.
That's right. You read the language and you, of course, are aware of the linguistic range and depth of Othello's speeches. And you might think that you need to declaim this because you have elements that are epic and rhapsodic as well as things that are really explosive with a kind of tortured muscularity that you might not associate with everyday speech. And yet, I thought Seth Gilliam did a wonderful job of respecting the extraordinary register of the language while making it real and accessible to us here in the 21st century.
Okay, what about Richard III in Lenox, Massachusetts, performed by Shakespeare and Company?
I thought the actors there also were terrific. The Richard stars John Douglas Thompson, another African-American actor who 2 years ago performed a magnificent Richard III on stage at Shakespeare and Company. And likewise, this is a play that's in some ways even more difficult to perform because the language is even more remote and the history is so remote. And yet, I thought they did a wonderful job of making this exciting, accessible, and relevant to today. The audience was cheering. They were engaged. They were participating. And they really, and this may seem paradoxical if you know the story of Richard III, but they felt a sense of pathos when the villain, this evil, tyrannical villain, dies at the end.
Well, back up a little bit and give us briefly the synopsis of both of them and why both these plays are quite relevant in these times.
Well, Othello, first of all, I think is a wonderful love story, and love stories are eternal. But it's great because in part paradoxically, it's a wretched play to watch, as you may remember, since the villain succeeds all too easily in taking a heroic man who is partly characterized by supreme self-composure and reducing him to spasms of murderous violence under false pretenses. And you may know that the play has a history of being interrupted in performance by people who can't take it anymore.
I could barely take it, I'll tell you, old Iago.
Right. But I think that is partly because despite whatever anger and frustration you may feel towards Othello for being so foolish and gullible, that you do agree at some level with his sentiment when he contemplates murdering Desdemona and says, "Oh, Iago, the pity of it," right? You sense that horrible sense of loss, again, because I think this is a love story that tells the story of a love that is heroic in its power and sweep. Remember, this is a marriage between a black man and a white woman in a society that considers such a marriage to be abhorrent and horrific.
That could be spoken about right now, actually.
Indeed, right? And I purposely set a society, not in those times.
Right, exactly.
Right? A man can be the most dignified person in the world and have achieved a status of eminent power.
And the themes in both Othello and Richard III are, what are you reading into both of them? Because we're talking about, the evilness and the love story of Othello and Richard III. We're talking about a damaged physically and emotionally Richard and how he interacts with the people around him. What are you reading from that for our time today?
Well,
With President Obama, right. I know you've been thinking about that.
I was going to say I saw both plays through the lens of President Obama's situation right now. With regard to Othello, I think what links Othello with President Obama is their hybrid status. Right, they are the ultimate insiders in having achieved such power, and yet they are still fundamentally outsiders because of their race. And you may remember in Othello, there's a curious inconsistency that captures this situation that's easy to overlook. The play begins, you might remember, with Iago and Roderigo, the hapless gull who's pursuing Desdemona, going to the house of Desdemona to inform her father that
she's run away with a black man.
With a black guy, right?
Yeah, right, exactly.
And they do so using the most racist language possible. Even now, an old black ram is topping your white ewe, right? Awake the citizens with the bell or else the devil will make a grandsire of you. And he conjures up images of the black man as this animalistic sexual predator. And then warns the father of the consequences of miscegenation. And the father, of course, takes the bait, and he confronts Othello twice, once in public, once in the streets, and once at the Senate, with similarly racist language.
Are you suggesting people are taking the bait now?
The parallel that I see with Obama is that, like Obama, Othello never takes the bait. And he is not provoked, and he remains very self-composed. And I thought Seth Gilliam did a wonderful job of this.
Well, until the end,
No, but at the beginning, right? And he is so he has that habitually ingrained self-restraint that is necessary for black men of power in the public sphere.
Oh, I see.
Right?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then you may remember Othello very self-confidently asserts that he deserves someone like Desdemona, and he says that he fetches his life and being from men of royal siege, etc., which raises the question, if he's so confident, why does he elope? Why doesn't he simply marry Desdemona in public? I think that speaks volumes about Othello the character and reflects something about Obama and his anxieties, unspoken and unstated anxieties, as a black man.
I would say this, and then I want to get your take on Richard III in the same way. let's remember that he wooed Desdemona by articulating his bona fides. You know, that was the basis of it, not as a person per se, but here's what I have accomplished.
Right.
So I thought that was interesting. Here is the United States perhaps saying, oh, maybe we can like this guy because of all of that he has accomplished, right, and we can have a relationship with him in that way.
Right. But the one thing he's not allowed to be is the angry black man.
Okay. Right? Well, what about Richard III? How do you see President Obama in his administration?
Is the opposite of Obama. And I say this with a bit of wistfulness. It's not that I want to see Obama murder his way to power, but I'd like to see that single-minded pursuit of an ideal and a willingness to chop off people's heads, metaphorically, as Richard famously does. Off with his head is one of the famous lines from the play, when he is confronting his political enemies. Right?
So he gets mad.
Well, Richard will get mad, right? Richard will stop at nothing. And he's also a terrific showman, and he's a master of spin. He's defined in part by a brilliant theatricality.
And he's an outsider because of his handicap.
That's right, his handicap. But he's ruthless, and he's willing to use his power to further his ends. Now, it seems to me that Obama is too cautious as a politician, and that's obviously a reflection of his temperament and I think of a certain kind of philosophical skepticism. But my sense of Obama is that he doesn't go the full distance in being ruthless in the political sphere because of his fear that ruthlessness in politics by a black man will be associated with the angry black man, which further is associated with, again,
And what's the danger of that, the angry black man, for people who are wondering? What do you mean by that? You know?
It's the birth of the nation story. Mm. It's the idea that the angry black man is a threat to America and threat to the image of America that's presented in the film, The Birth of a Nation, the innocent white female virgin, the way Desdemona is, right? And associated with the sense of a predatory outsider is, again, a non-native darkness that can infiltrate and take over the country. So all of this stuff about how Obama is a Muslim, he's not an American, he's not a native American, all of this, I think, is associated with the sense that Obama is a threat of darkness from the outside. And Obama, like Othello, is always conscious of his dual status. Even to the end, you may remember, Othello, when he kills himself, refers to a turbaned and a malignant Turk, right, who beat a Venetian and traduced the state. But then it turns out that reference is to himself, and he twists it around and says, I took by the throat the circumcised dog and smote him thus, and he kills himself. So he is both a dark outsiderly threat, as well as the insider who defends the state against that threat. And Othello never overcomes that duality or hybridity. And it seems to me, and I don't want to psychologize Obama too much.
Yeah, you do. Go ahead.
But it seems to me Obama is still plagued by that. And I think his advisors, like Axelrod and Rahm Emanuel, in some respects, play the role of Iago in echoing Obama's deepest anxieties to him. You may remember one of the tactics that Iago uses is simply to echo Othello's words, honest, honest, my lord.
Yes.
indeed. Right. And he says, by heaven thou echoest me as if there were some monster too hideous to be shown, right?
Yeah.
And he goes on to say that the monster is the green-eyed monster jealousy that doth mock the meat it feeds upon. But the real monster, I think, is Othello's sense of himself as an animalistic other, which is really the projection from the racist imagination that he has internalized.
Which we've seen some of politically out here in the political sphere now.
Yeah,
this is a time of a great amount of political division and anxiety, as you've articulated, you know, both in these plays, but right now. Is that the reason you I'm guessing that they're doing heavy political drama in these local productions as opposed to, you know, the Shakespeare comedies that might be great for the summer.
That's very funny that you say that, because last summer at the very same venues, they were playing lighthearted comedies or comedies that in the past generation had been given a dark tinge, but which returned to their sort of comic exuberance. And I'm thinking about Twelfth Night mm-hmm. at Shakespeare and Company last summer, as well as Twelfth Night in New York. Mm-hmm. It's not unusual for it to have a dark ending. But last summer, they were both so celebratory.
Right.
And I attribute that in part to the hope that Obama raised. But now, after 1 year, boom, we're right back to the darkness.
Mm.
Right?
And do you think we'll stay there for a while? I mean, it's interesting how art reflects what's happening in the moment. You know?
I'm afraid, I hate to say this, it pains me to say this, Kelly, but I'm afraid that it will. I mean, that's my take. You, of course, know much more about this than I do and have the pulse of the political scene in America. But my sense is that Obama has irretrievably damaged himself, and that he will never fully recover or restore himself to the position he was in at the beginning of his presidency.
So people are listening and they're going, can't you just watch the play? Where'd you get all this? You know? So,
but,
just want to ask that question.
Okay, first of all, Richard III is a historical play about history and politics and the pathways to power. And Othello is, in addition to being a sublime love story, a play about the effects of race and how race intersects with gender, but also of how race affects those who are in power and how they are perceived in that society. So, no, I'm not making this up.
It's right there.
That's right. Mm-hmm. The plays resonate today because Shakespeare was so prescient. I don't want to just repeat the adage that he is universal, but these plays, I think, do demonstrate the universality of his writing.
Now, part of your expertise is also in performance, and I have to say I was extremely impressed with the performance of the Shakespeare in the Park here, and you've been impressed with both productions of Othello and the one in Lenox.
Yes, with both.
The Richard III.
The Richard III. Mm-hmm. However, I really should confess that I found some of the roles in the Commonwealth Shakespeare Othello were rather weak.
Mm. So that's the one here in Boston on the Common.
That's right. I think
this is wearing your reviewer hat. Okay.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Actors need to make the distinction between naturalizing the language and conversationalizing it to the point of deflating it and reducing and robbing it of its poetry.
Right? Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, that's a criticism they can use next summer, I guess. For right now, they're both pretty good. We've been talking Shakespeare with our arts and culture contributor, Eugene Koh. He's a professor of English at Wellesley College. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Othello runs through August the 15th. For more information about showtimes, visit comshakes.org. That's comshakes.org. And Shakespeare and Company's production of Richard III runs through September the 5th. To learn more, visit shakespeare.org. This is the Callie Crossley Show. We're a production of WGBH Radio, Boston's NPR station for news and culture.